Okay, let's go ahead and get started. We've got three more sessions on this topic left, today, tomorrow, and Thursday. But it has been a while since we were on this topic, about 4 days now, so I'm going to take just a little time, and for some of those of you that weren't with us last week, just to get you just a little bit of a sense of what we were doing, and then we'll proceed on. This session is about Satan's attack on society and on the church, and I opened with this slide last week. We talked a little bit about the attack of Satan on Job and some of the ramifications of it. In essence, Satan trying to get Job, vis-a-vis his wife, to abandon God. We talked some about the war aspects of it that Paul talks about as he closes out his letter to the Ephesians. And then just some graphics here to kind of help position our mindset about the seriousness of what we are dealing with. We also talked about how I believe, and I think many do, and you to some extent, believe our country is in free fall. We talked about in Proverbs 14:34, it says, righteousness will exalt a nation. Well, if righteousness will exalt a nation, I think it's fair to understand that unrighteousness will maybe do the opposite. We talked about how our country was maybe in free fall economically. Our national debt per capita is about $56,000. Per taxpayer, it's about $152,000 and growing. We talked about, we touched on, and we'll talk more probably tomorrow about the educational dilemma that I think our country is in. We spend more money than just about anybody, but don't do better than many, many. We talked about how governmentally and judicially we have active judges. We didn't speak, nor will we speak politically, because I find plenty of fault to go around on whatever side of the coin you consider yourself to be politically. And obviously, morally, this country is in free fall. Titus chapter 2, verse 5, talking about keepers of the home, and one of the duties of the women, but it's not simply a fault of the women, but one of the things that certainly has occurred is our materialism has overtaken our desire for doing some of the godly duties that God has given us. And then the concept of marriage and the various ramifications of it that we will probably talk some about today, and Wade will talk some about as he gets into that in Matthew 5, I assume. Do nations turn themselves around? Seldom, if ever. But there is not a lost hope. People can turn themselves around. So individually, we and those we come in contact, there is a great hope. We talked about Satan's strategy, and I talked about the concept of worldview, which was really the essence, probably, of the first three or so days last week. And we talked about what our worldview is. Well, most of us assembled here have a biblical or Christian worldview. That's our set of beliefs. And I gave a definition of what a worldview, how we could look upon it. Alvin Toffler said, every person carries in his head a mental model of the world. And then a rather lengthy description or definition. Worldview is a framework or a set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our calling and future in it. This vision need not be fully articulated. It may not be explicitly developed into a systematic conception of life. It may not even be theoretically deepened into a philosophy. It may not even be codified into creedal form. It may be greatly refined through culture and historical development. Nevertheless, this system is a channel for the ultimate beliefs which give direction and meaning to life. It is the integrative and interpretative framework by which order and disorder are judged. It is the standard by which reality is managed and pursued. It is the set of hinges on which all our everyday thinking and doing turns. Obviously, that is not my definition. It is James Althea's definition, but I found it to be rather thorough, although rather lengthy and a little bit lacking of periods. But he did make a better point than maybe I would have made, so I went ahead and used it. Basically, what I understand that to be saying, or as I'm using the term worldview, it is our value system on which we base our beliefs, and therefore we base our decisions. And I think that is Satan's real strategy. If he can change our worldview to be a worldview that is not biblical, then he doesn't have to convince us about abortion. He doesn't have to convince us about homosexuality. He doesn't have to convince us about fornication, because those will be our deviant view, will lead us to deviant conclusions. The only worldview that reaches the right conclusions on all of those issues, I believe to be the biblical worldview. And then I use this graphic, which maybe can help just sum up what I've been trying to say in this summary. Our worldview is our set of knowledge, assumptions, and beliefs, which determines what our values are, and then they determine what our choices are. I don't have to, or Satan does not have to get you to make wrong choices if he gets you to have a deviant worldview, because it all, I believe, falls or moves from that. Okay, with that, that was last week. That was my first seven sessions. I did have a couple of questions that came out of some of the things, and the first one really comes out of Friday's session, which was my personal favorite. Not that it was the best, it's just my personal favorite, when we were talking about the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. And I got this question, and I don't know if the person who asked it is still here, but this was my first opportunity to answer it. We talked about how pain can be helpful and good. And pain can sometimes, if we allow it to, bring us to a closer relationship with God. The question was, is evil ever helpful? Well, yes, I think the answer to that I would give is yes, evil can be helpful. Now, that is not to be confused with evil as ever being good. If evil is, as I define it, or I understand it, is the absence of good, you really can't say evil is every good, because then you're saying the absence of good is good, and that is not a logical statement. But that wasn't the question. The question was, is evil ever helpful? And I think sometimes evil can be helpful. My mind goes back to Luke chapter 22, verses 31, 32, where Jesus is talking to Peter, and he says there, Satan wants to have you and sift you. And then in the latter part of those two verses, he says, and this is a paraphrase, so that you can then help or be in a position to maybe help others. Peter was going through some difficulties. Maybe they were of an evil nature. I don't know, or Satan was tempting him with evil. Jesus said, I'm praying for you, and as you come out of this, you will be better able to help others. So I think sometimes evil in our life can position us, if we come through it properly, to be in a better position to help others when they go through it, because some of you have gone through things that are not good and maybe even evil that I haven't, and vice versa. And I think that's one of our being able to bear one another's burdens. I also think of the Apostle Paul. He did a lot of evil, the persecution of the church. But I am persuaded that is one of the reasons he became such a committed apostle, because he had that always in his mind. Was it good that he did that? No. Was he glad he did that? No. But I think there are some good that can come out of this. Now, I want to be very careful that I do not, I am not misunderstood, pardon me. Romans chapter 6, verse 1 says, shall we sin that grace may abound? We don't want to take the position, well, let's do evil so we can become better Christians. That obviously is a non-starter. But when we do something wrong, let's learn from it so that we are then stronger. And in that sense, I would take the position that maybe evil can be helpful, even though not desirable. The second question, a little longer, and this could apply to probably every congregation here, I'm going to guess. What is the underlying problem of a congregation that has a hard time finding teachers who can bring meat to the table? And if that doesn't apply to your congregation, don't raise your hand, but look me up. Because I want to understand why it's not, because it is a dilemma. Well, I don't have a definitive answer to that, but again, it doesn't keep me from having some thoughts. Probably the underlying problem of this congregation is it's made up of people. And any time you make a congregation up of people, you're going to have problems. It's that old saying, the church would be a wonderful place if it wasn't for the people. But the people are what make up the church. There could be a multiplicity of reasons. I'm sure there are a multiplicity of reasons. There may be a motivational issue. Maybe that congregation, the leadership of that congregation, or the members themselves have not motivated themselves in order to challenge themselves to do it. And ultimately, despite the need for good leadership, it comes down to each one of us to motivate ourselves to do that. You are going to learn meat. You are going to learn the Bible in the privacy of your own study, probably far more than you are in the assembled study. The assembled study is very, very important. But if you want to really learn what the Bible says, you crack open the book and you get some quiet time and you go at it. So there may be a motivational issue there. There may be a lack of feeding by the leadership of a congregation so that the flock is never fed meat and you can't teach what you don't know. Now that does not lay all of the blame upon the leadership. If you're in a congregation where the leadership is not really oriented toward giving you meat, go get meat. You can get it. And maybe you can be one of those that leads the way. It has been my observation that meat produces meat. And what I mean by that is when you're around people that are dealing with meat, it makes you want to deal with meat. It makes you want to dig. That's one of the things that happens at a meeting like this. And I'm not saying that any of the classes are really meat. That's not mine to choose or to decide. But we sometimes are charged up, if you will. And I think that can be a good thing, to go back and do better and consider it that way. It's a difficult problem. I don't know the total answer. What I can say to each of us as individuals is, let's get more into meat, and I think it may be a little more contagious than we realize. But will that take work? Yeah. But it will be greatly appreciated, I think, by the congregation. I had a third question, and I'm not going to deal with it today because I'm going to deal with it tomorrow. It's just sometimes hard to see what we need to see. And these two young men, and I honestly have forgotten who they are. At one time I probably knew. But if you're the parents of these kids, let me know. I didn't get your permission because nobody else knows who they are either. I want to talk a little bit now about, as I lead into this section, and what we're going to deal with today is Satan's attack on the church. One of the things that I believe is extremely important for the church is to pass the baton. And there's a lot of baton passing going on. It's going on right now, I think, because I think there's a class downstairs in batonology, or whatever you want to call it. They're passing the baton. Our job as adults, and if you want to consider yourself a mature Christian, it's largely to transfer the faith. It's like a relay race. There's that baton and it gets passed. And what happens to the team when they drop the baton? They're either disqualified or they're hopelessly behind. And if we don't pass the baton, i.e. our faith, that is exactly what will happen. In years past, the postmodern era, you would run into faith in many places because the Christian faith was maybe one of the dominating aspects of our environment. You would find elements of the Christian faith on TV shows, on radio shows, in the media, in our schools, in civic functions. But we are now in the post-Christian era. We are no, I don't believe we're a Christian nation. We are in a post-Christian era. And no longer is the Christian worldview the dominant worldview. We live in a post-Christian era where it is the exception to run into Christ in our society and in our world rather than the rule. Therefore, it is even more critical than ever before that we pass the baton. That is our Christian faith. Not only to be held, but to be transferred. And that is an element of Satan's attack on the church. Satan is perfectly happy for us to gather together and worship and sing our songs and do our prayers as long as we don't pass the baton. Well, many of you are. And I know, as other teachers have been saying, we're talking to the choir, but we need to be reminded of this. How does Satan attack? Well, I believe Satan attacks at least on four fronts. Last week, we talked largely about his attack on society. However, these do overlap because the way he attacks society is going to be many times the way he attacks the church, the way he attacks other things. Satan also attacks us, pardon me, as individuals. Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, warns us as Christians that Satan is a roaring lion. He's going to attack the family. We'll spend a little bit of time on that probably tomorrow. And he is certainly going to attack the church. One of the things I would like to do is take just a moment and go... Well, before I do that, let me just read this last bullet. Our society tries to avoid any possibility of offending anyone except Christians. And that point's been made in numerous talks and in numerous classes. I'm going to take just a moment and go to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3, 4, and 5. You can listen or you can turn. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, I'm going to begin reading with verse 3. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of the strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringeth into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. It's not quite as lengthy, but it's another passage from the Apostle Paul, like what he gave us in Ephesians chapter 6, talking about this battle that we are in. And we need to remind ourselves, as we talked about last week, you cannot use secular weapons to defeat spiritual enemies. It will not work. Whether those secular weapons are legislation, whether they are pop psychology, whether they're self-help books, that may have some elements of help in them, but are not the answer. You defeat spiritual enemies with spiritual weapons. And therefore, until we fix our heads or our hearts, we will never fix our feet. And we are often trying to address what I call feet issues without addressing head issues. And it just does not work. That's why one of the reasons I think legislation is not very effective. Battle deals, according to the passage here in verse 5, with imaginations or speculations. It deals with distracting people from the knowledge of God, and it has to deal with taking every thought captive. All of those are mind issues, because that is where the battle is. The battleground is not Gettysburg. The battleground is not Normandy. The battleground is not the Middle East. The battleground is right here. And that's where Satan fights his battles, and that's where we have to find him. As Solomon tells us in Proverbs 23:7, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. You're familiar with that passage, but it bears a little bit of dealing with. In the passage that I read for you in verse 4, it says, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Some translations render strongholds fortresses, and that, I think, is an appropriate consideration. What is a stronghold? What is that fortress? It's that mindset that holds you and I hostage. And when we have a deviant worldview, we are held hostage by that deviant worldview. Satan has so infiltrated man that man has adopted Satan's thinking about the world rather than God's. We had, as has been mentioned, an excellent lesson on adoption last night. And Alan mentioned how we are the adopted children of God. Absolutely true. But I think Satan is maybe in the adoption business too, if we're not awfully careful. In 2 Corinthians 5, just to look at that, maybe just very briefly in a little bit more detail, there's the concept of casting down imaginations. I understand those imaginations could be a multiplicity of things, but I've labeled them as false philosophy, satanic reasoning, various systems of deviant worldviews that have become so entrenched that they become strongholds for the enemies of God. The foes of Christianity pretend to a great deal of reason and rely on the resisting of the gospel. Every high thing, that exalted human reasoning, we talked about the Enlightenment era, the Age of Reason, we talked about modernism, which elevated man's reason, and sometimes maybe even those of us in the church get a little higher view of our reasoning capacity than we should have. The Bible calls that pride. And then the bringing into captivity, a figure obviously from a military thought, but one of the ways we fight Satan is to bring those things into captivity, those strongholds of paganism, pride, sin, deviant worldviews. We bring them into captivity so that they no longer dominate us. All the plans of our lives should be controlled by the will of God. You might remember in James chapter 4, verse 13 and following, it's a passage that says that, you know, we should consider God's will before we do anything. It's not talking about not planning for the future. It's talking about planning for the future without considering God's will. And sometimes we need to be very careful of that. Sometimes Christians will move to a new geographical area before they have looked into what kind of a support system is there. What kind of church is there? If you get an opportunity to transfer in your job or for whatever reason have a greater opportunity, that's wonderful. But just stop and think before you do it, the impact it's going to have you on you and your family spiritually. Now we move to Satan's attack on the church, maybe in a little more specific way. Truth has to dominate and define the Lord's church. If it doesn't, then it's no longer the Lord's church. Truth has to dominate and define what the Lord's church is. In John chapter 8, verses 44 and 45, it talks about, in direct opposition to the world, we have the children of God, we have the children of Satan. And truth differentiates them in the conflict. A couple of passages, and I don't think I put them up here. Let me just look. No, I didn't. I'll give them to you verbally. Galatians chapter 2, verse 9, and 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15, talk about pillars or pillars of truth. It's from the Greek word stylos. And it means to be a pillar. It's talking in one case about the truth, and I believe in the other case it's talking about individuals. But you're pillars in the church because you stand for the truth. And that's what we are to do. The church, however, has a growing fear of being rejected by our culture. Is being rejected fun? No. But being rejected by our culture is a lot more preferable to than being rejected by our Lord. Therefore, I think we would agree we have to take the biblical worldview on all cultural and social issues. I'm not talking about being militant. We can be militant within the confines of the law of the land. We should not be militant unless it is a direct violation of a commandment of God. beyond the laws of the land, but we have ways to protest this. I am against abortion. You probably are too, but I am not going to be militant about it to the extent of violating laws of the land unless the government says we have to do it. It's still a choice. We don't have to do it. So it's not being forced on us, although it is a great abomination. And I think we also need to care about Satan's positions on these various issues for the simple fact they are leading people, families, by the droves to hell. Now, I could sugarcoat that, but I can't speak the truth and do much sugarcoating on that. We're told in John chapter 7 and chapter 15, the world will hate you, will not like you. If you and I are simply in the business of being liked, we're in the wrong business because it's not going to happen unless we don't confront it. The church, however, is to care about the world but never be a friend of the world. I do not believe the problem is that the church is in the world. The problem is that the world is in the church. And therein lies the problem that we have to be very, very careful about. But there are those that seem to want to make the world like them. Well, that's a natural tendency to be liked, but the truth is not liked by the world. In fact, we're told that. The church's stand, I believe the only time the church has ever made any significant impact on the world is when it stood firm. That's not the only time that people have come into assemblies, but the only time we've ever made a real impact on the world is when we stand firm as the church. Faddish efforts, and I looked that one up. It does have two D's. I didn't think it did. I kept spelling it F-A-D-I-S-H, and the computer didn't like it. So about 3 o'clock this morning, I got a dictionary. Faddish efforts, music, psychological soft sell to appease culture betray the primary responsibility of the church. Absolutely, period. So we don't want to do that. But I don't think Satan has any need to change his strategies as long as they're working. And I think the strategies of the first century are still working today. And I'm going to spend a little time, maybe rather briefly, going through that. I want to look at 13 or 14 New Testament church examples. And when I say 13 or 14, there's nothing that sounds like brevity to you, I know. But I will try to move through them, and I think I can because of your familiarity with them. In the New Testament, we have 14 plus letters to churches. To 13 different churches. 14 plus because more than one letter was written to some churches, i.e. Corinth or Thessalonica. 13 churches because Ephesus got letters from both Paul and from Christ. But that still was one church, although separated by several decades. There were 7 plus letters written by Paul and 7 by Christ. And I'm going to go through rather rapid fire those churches. There was the church at Rome. What was the problem with the church at Rome? Well, there was sexual immorality. Romans chapter 1, there was conflict between Jews and Gentiles, chapters 1 and 2, ethnic pride. There was antinomianism, chapter 3, lawlessness, doctrinal confusion. The church at Corinth, chapter 1, there were divisions. Chapter 5, tolerance of sin, ignoring immorality. Chapter 7, marital confusion. Chapters 12 through 14, assembly misconduct. The church at Galatia, going back to their old ways, chapter 1, elevating Judaism, chapter 3, fruits of the flesh versus fruits of the spirit, chapter 6, erring brethren, chapter 6, fruits of the flesh and spirit was chapter 5, if I said 6. Ephesus, mostly reminders, giving a fuller understanding of the glory of the church. But there is in the last part of that book, as we started our discussion this week, the intensity of the war that we're going about. The Church of Philippi probably had fewer difficulties that were pointed out. It's sometimes considered the kind of the crown jewel of these, because Paul had most things of thankfulness and admonitions to them. At Colossae, they were fighting false teachers, philosophies, Gnosticisms, chapter 2, verse 8. Difficulty in grasping the deity of Christ. Thessalonica, confusion about the end times, chapters 4 and 5. Paul's challenge, chapter 2. Immorality, chapter 4. Laziness, 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3. Just to go through those very briefly. When we move to the seven churches in Revelation, which understandably Rick chose not to deal with, and I'm just going to deal with them a little bit, but you can answer these questions. What was the problem with the church at Ephesus? They had lost their first love. That was the easy one. What about the church at Pergamos? Well, I place there the concept of compromising with the world. They were going through compromise. We have the church at Thyatira. This was a church that was dealing with, or apparently involved with, the tolerance of sin. We have the church at Sardis, which is described in the third chapter of Revelation as lifeless. We have the church at Laodicea, which would be probably almost as easy for you as the church at Ephesus. They were the lukewarm church. It's interesting, and I don't know how much of a progression we have there, but it seems to me interesting that we've got a lost love, compromise with the world, tolerance of sin, lifelessness, and apostasy. Now, I don't know that it always flows in exactly that way, but I do think maybe there is a little bit of reason to the order of which we are given of those churches. And I think those probably would be five things that I would point that Satan very successfully attacks even the Lord's church on. Not keeping our love. It was only a few decades from Ephesus went from Paul shedding tears as he met with the elders to Jesus having to write this. I might just briefly comment that there's really two churches of the seven that Jesus wrote to in Revelations that really didn't have any warning. Smyrna, chapter 2, and that was a persecuted church. Philadelphia, chapter 3, that had an open door, an evangelistic church. Maybe it's when people are either persecuted or they're busy that they do better in following the Lord. And there may be a lesson for us there. I'll leave that with you. Satan tactics within the church probably can be multiplicities, but I've listed three. I think one of them is deception. It goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And John writes in Revelations 20 and 3, and cast him into a bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should what? Deceive the nations no more. Rick will probably deal more with that. There's the element of distracting. I think Satan tries to distract churches. We see that in the book of Corinthians. The people all got all wrapped up in their spiritual gifts, and they became distracted about what worship was really all about. And also in the book of Corinthians, as well as in other passages, there were divisions. Now, when those divisions are doctrinal, then things have to be addressed. And if they can't be fixed, then we have to find a place where we can worship in truth. But many times these divisions are in judgmental areas or non-essential areas or personality areas. And you've all seen this occur. It's a tragedy when it does occur, and it's a glee to Satan. Satan, however, I believe, is attacking the church today. As I said, truth has to dominate. Therefore, attacks on the truth are attacks on church. And hopefully, before I'm done this week, we'll talk about his attack on the Word of God. Religion has become commercialized. The whole structure of religion is organization is no longer flat. It's pyramid, because that's what man is used to in our corporate or civic environment. The trendy churches, user-friendly churches, worship goals. We have forgotten that worship is to reverence and honor God, not necessarily to build us up. Now, if we reverence and honor God properly, we will be built up. But there is a difference in, a great difference, I believe, in the goal. Most of the people that probably in America go to church on Sunday morning are not going with proper worship goals, in my opinion. Doctrinal steadfastness is critical, as is spiritual discernment. Now, what I wanted to get to, and we won't complete this slide this morning. I have listed five areas where I am very concerned about the effect of Satan's attack upon the church. You could list five others, and yours would be probably just as valid. But I had to do my picking. If you were at Eminence this year, in the second hour of my class, I touched on a couple of these. I make no apology for repeating them because they're that important, and most of you weren't there. I've listed the purity of the church as maybe the one that is most troubling to me, because it seems to me to be a outgrowth for the others. I believe there was a time when the church was pure, or at least there was a time when the church tried to be pure. I am increasingly concerned that the church is not that concerned with purity. Oh, we are intellectually concerned with it, but our actions, I'm not sure, always betray that. The power of Christ to make a man or a woman pure is great, but we have choice in which to do. Peter Sorokin, a Russian-born Harvard sociologist, in 1961, wrote in an article entitled The American Sex Revolution, and I want to read this paragraph. There has been a growing preoccupation with our writers in the social sewers, broken homes of disloyal parents and unloved children, the bedroom of the prostitute, a Cannery Row brothel, the den of criminals, street combers, or gang of delinquents, hate-laden prisons, courtroom of dishonest judges, the sex adventures of ermitized cavemen. I've always thought that was an accurate phrase. The sex adventures of urbanized cavemen, the loves of adulterers, the fornicators, masochists, sadists, mistresses. All these are seductively prepared and served with all the trimmings. I think he nailed it. And I think they are being so seductively served that we sometimes in the church are beginning to osmotically, absorb them into turning our head the other way about a lot of these issues. And when we do that, we no longer deserve to be called the Lord's church, period. If he chooses to continue to save us when we do that, that is his grace in overdrive. Pornography is moving from mail order, street corners, hotel rooms, to now the living room. Who here would build a new house and put an open sewer in the middle? But we do it. It's called cable. It's called dish. Do I have a TV in my house? Yes, I do. And this is not an anti-TV, because I don't like anti-TV sermons very much, but yet there comes a tremendous responsibility with anything like that, internet, TV, to use it in a Christian fashion. I don't know if the church is less pure now than it was 50 years ago, because I was only, well, I wasn't very old. And I worry that it's my age that's causing me to be concerned. Well, if that's the case, I'm just stuck with it, because I am concerned. I go to congregation after congregation and things appall me. I had an elder within this last year who is not here, nor is anyone from his congregation here, came to me and said, "We have two members that are living together. Should we be doing something? Thank you. That's about what I said. And these people were in their 70s. They were in their 70s. So it's not just a young people thing. I believe it is God's will that not only we as individuals be pure, but we as a church be pure. Well, how are we as a church going to be pure? We're going to be pure when we as individual Christians are pure, because we make up the church. But it is, and I guess I think it was John, said that he can be a little confrontational and enjoy it. I can give lessons on that. Because I don't want to go that far. My nature is to be confrontational if I'm not awfully careful. But to be non-confrontational in the place of sin is an absolute disaster, brothers and sisters. And souls are at stake. As members of our congregations, I have lost count of the congregations I go to where the members can't remember the last time discipline was exercised in their congregation. Well, again, if that's your congregation and there's been no need for discipline for 30 years, come see me, because I want to go there. That's a wonderful group of people. And I guess that segues into my second one here, is church discipline. It seems to me that if we're not awfully careful, Satan's attack on the church is going to be successful because of this. James Wilson, a UCLA sociologist, observed an interesting fact about urban life, and he wrote, "The crime rate escalates on those streets where broken windows are not repaired. Failure to replace broken windows makes an announcement to the public that the standards have been lowered and authority abandoned. Wilson sees such practices of disrepair as an invitation for further crime without the threat of adverse consequences." And I believe that's probably true. But what's true of an urban neighborhood, I think, is quite true of the Lord's church. If repair of broken windows or actions that need to be taken are not taken, isn't that an open invitation that there are no earthly consequences for our conduct? I want to read to you Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 11. "Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." Now what's that mean? It means if you don't address a thing in an expedient manner, you're just opening the floodgates for continued activity. Now there's a reason the Lord has not given us a time frame with which to address certain issues, because I do believe judgment is necessary. I do believe cases have different idiosyncrasies and people are different, and our congregations and our leadership need to take discernment. But when we do not keep the church pure, either by restoring or disfellowshipping, dare I use that word, I believe Satan has a big smile on his face. Satan doesn't want me to necessarily quit coming to church. He just wants me to come to a church that's no longer the church, and he'll be quite happy. Now, is this an easy thing to do? No. Do our elders have a tremendous challenge? Absolutely. And we as members need to support them in a biblical way in order for this to be worked through. Now, I know there are a lot of you, from having talked to you in your various congregations, where you are doing a diligent effort in this area. So please just bear with me. But I do believe it's so easy for us to turn the other cheek. Well, no, it's not turning the other cheek. Turn the other way. Turn the other way when some things need to be addressed. Sexual laxity. I'm not teaching the young people by themselves. They're interspersed here. But I have had more than one young person in the church tell me that they are much more comfortable dating a boy outside of the church than inside of the church. Because the moral conduct of the boy outside of the church is sometimes better than the moral conduct of the boy inside of the church. Well, I don't advocate you date outside of the church. That's not the point of that statement at all. And I know you younger people are probably getting a pretty good dose of it down there, in some aspects of it, with Todd and with Jeremy this week. But it's wrong. Unmarried people can't live together. I don't care what your age is. It is wrong. Always has been, always will be, despite what we say about it or do or don't do about it. And souls are at stake. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. The clock is going to keep me from going into this very much, but Wade will address it to some extent, and if he doesn't, I will come back to it. Marriage is a wonderful institution. One man, one woman, till death do us part. It's not that complicated, and you know that. But what congregation hasn't been hit, and if yours hasn't, it will be, with marriage, divorce, and remarriage. To me, this is a very hard issue that's very simple. Number one, if you're married in a godly way, just stay that way. Stay married. Stay married. If you have the tragedy of going through a divorce, I believe the Bible is going to teach us in Matthew chapter 5 and in Matthew chapter 19, the only people that have a right to remarry are the innocent parties when adultery has been engaged in. Period. I do not believe 1 Corinthians 7 says abandonment gives you the right to remarry. I believe maybe abandonment, you may have to dissolve the marriage for financial reasons. I believe if a woman is getting beat up by her husband, she may have to get away from that so that she's not beaten to a pulp. But I see nowhere where remarriage is ever allowed except for sexual infidelity. But the church is really struggling with this because our fleshly passions want all of these loopholes. That's the way I see it. Do I have great sympathy for a young person who made a mistake and now wants to get out of it and remarry? Yes, I have sympathy for them, but it doesn't change the Word of God. It simply emphasizes how important that initial decision of who you marry and when you marry and if you marry is. I'll save that one. That was paucity of leadership. And it's not a negative thing. It's just a fact. And it deals with a lot of these. I know a lot of men, I think, would make good officers in the church but aren't eligible because of some of the things I just put up. I've got on the screen right now. And it's sad. And it is killing the church. Which congregation here wouldn't like to have two more elders? Well, of course you would. It's probably one of the leading things that is really crippling the church. So you young people that haven't made some of the mistakes of my generation or even my children's generation, keep these things in mind. I really pray that you will do better than my generation has done. Human nature tells me that's being a little bit optimistic, but you will see. I'll be gone. You will see. But Satan's attack on the church has been skillfully maneuvered because he attacks with things he knows we want. Remember what I said last week, those of you here? Satan's sale is easy because he's selling what we want, what we as human beings want. And that makes it rather easy, but we have to be very, very careful about it. Okay, my clock says that my time is up, so I will stop. We'll start there, but tomorrow we'll be primarily dealing with his attack on the family and looking at some of the things that, yes, they've already been mentioned by various people, but we'll look at them a little differently. I want to look at parenting. I want to look at being a Christian child. I want to look at what society has done to that, as time permits. So if you've got any questions you'd like for me to specifically address or us to collectively address, just put them in the box, and we'll do that.